Bonjour and welcome back to Canuck as a Slur, where for the second episode in a row, my co-host here, Quinn, has not worn a costume or shaved a Ken Carter goatee as was in the contract.
So, listener, if you listened to the last episode, then you know that we are recording precisely 3 minutes after we finished the last recording.
That you can't prove
during
that
time, I did not, in fact, have time to entirely shave, tragically.
I mean, I had time to change my backdrop. I don't know what you're...
I understand you. Your dedication to your podcast is greater than my dedication to your podcast. I apologize.
Yeah, this is the problem I keep running into. It's a real moral failing among the guests.
I didn't see you wearing a space suit for the FTL guesting.
Yeah, I did. I wore my cool...
Oh, yeah, you did.
Soviet synthwave wrestler outfit. Honestly, the best time to dress up for a podcast is when you can see each other, but the video is not being published, and then everyone just has to take your word for it. Yeah, we just finished talking about the other people in The Devil at Your Heels and kind of what happened with their careers and lives after that movie came out. And we talked a little bit about Ken Carter and how he kind of threw up his hands and said he didn't know anything about where everyone's money went. And
all of the good stuff, me. All of the bad stuff, not me.
Everyone in town loves him. This is the same town where the newspaper was saying, like, yeah, he's ran out of all his goodwill and his decaying ramp is blocking our drainage. But to get back on the subject of Ken Carter, there is another excellent video available you can watch online for free. Made in 2013 is an excellent retrospective on the rest of Carter's career that interviews many of the people involved in the events. Graham Hart, a television broadcaster who also had a first-hand account to offer, hosted the special presentation by CHEX in Peterborough, Ontario. Now, you watched this one, right?
I don't believe I did.
Also, Peterborough weirdly comes up a few times. It comes up here, and this is also, I guess this is foreshadowing because this hasn't come out yet, but this is where Romana Didelo's followers tried to arrest the police, also in Peterborough.
Oh, yeah, the Queen of the Federation of Canada, or the Republic of Canada. Yeah.
And then I was reading about, what was it? It was just like, oh, yeah, when I was reading about the implementation of the metric system, because I was fact-checking on that, and there was this, there was an MP who was, like, virulently anti-metric system. Like, it was his whole, his main kind of, like, single voter issue, basically.
Strapping on my SI unit suicide vest and sprinting into Parliament Hill to prevent the evil meter.
Yeah, and he was the MP for Peterborough, so I don't know what's going on over there. Weird shit in the water in Peterborough. To kind of get everyone back in the scheme of it, the Devil at Your Heels runs from 1975 through 1979 inclusive, and it came out in 1981. So in 1982-83, he's saying, yeah, I'm making record-setting jumps, but as always, as you can imagine, this is dubious. In the narration, Hart says that Carter makes a record-breaking 186-foot jump in 1982. So that means, you guessed it, we get to check back in with the folks at Guinness World Records.
The surviving brother of Guinness.
Yes. To refresh ourselves on what the longest car jump was. Now, this was not as straightforward as I'd hoped.
They still hadn't figured out what a standardized car was.
Yeah. Well, are you ready for this?
Oh, boy.
In the 1976 edition, published 1975, the record for a T-bone dive in a car is listed at 176 feet set in 1973, breaking the record of 127 feet, which was set in 1974, as listed in the 1975 edition, published in 1974. This record, set by Dusty Russell, a real person, not a euphemism for cowboy sex, came only a month after his previous record-setting jump of 116 feet, as listed in the 1974 edition, published 1973. Does that make sense?
Vaguely? Kinda?
It shouldn't, because it implies that not only did Russell smash the other guy's record by nearly 40 feet, he also traveled back in time by over a year to do it.
Oh, okay. I missed that part.
Well, yeah, because
I was stuck thinking, like, that is a wildly huge jump in that record.
Well, it is.
So, yeah, like a hundred. That's like, basically an extra 50% on top.
Yeah. But it says he set the 176-foot record in 1973, but it wasn't in the edition. So then a record that happens chronologically after gets printed.
Okay.
And then it gets, like, retroactively printed as, like, possibly it hadn't been verified or had been missed, but
like a correction or
Once again, like the book is just wildly inconsistent because if you try to,
I guess like your ability to claim a world record is less based on you actually achieving a world record and more you being the first person to talk to the Guinness brother.
I think a lot of it is just kind of a sloppy editorial standard, but
oh yeah,
it's hard to say.
Doing 23andMe on that dusty guy, finding out he's Irish and just, no, we're not putting him in.
Yeah.
Dusty driving a car bomb into the Guinness Book of World Records office. Cut that if you need to.
I don't think that's an actionable threat.
I have just made, in short time, I just realized that I have made two suicide bombing related jokes.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And again, this is also complicated by like the UK and US editions are laid out differently and they have like conflicting pieces of information. So it continues to be a hot mess.
Yep.
But for the 1982, we were going by publishing year. So the edition published 1981, this entry was finally updated. In the usual place alongside motorcycle stunting, it simply reads, the category of ramp jumping with a car has been discontinued.
Damn. Not allowed to do it anymore.
No, and this is like exactly when these claims are being made.
Actually very convenient for Ken Carter, because he can jump anything and just say it's a record now.
I mean, that's what he's been doing the whole time.
Yeah. You see that? You see that right there? Me going over that curb? Record.
No further entries were included until 4 years later when car ramp jumping was quietly reintroduced.
Okay. Who the hell is in charge of picking these things? What is the board meeting in which, like, 4 years ago, the manager that you really hated got rid of car jumping, but then he quit last May or something? So he's like, all right, guys, I know we talked about this last time. I say we bring it back. I say we bring it back.
Guinness seems to have a pattern over time of they're trying to toe this line of they want to have records of endurance and a lot of like stunts and stuff like this. Yeah. But they also can't, or they don't want to be seen as encouraging dangerous behavior. So in some of these early 70s editions, they talk about how they've discontinued the eating metal category and stuff.
Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe good for that.
Yeah. Well, and they're like, well, no one's ever going to beat this guy who ate a whole bike or whatever it was.
Most razor blades eaten. Have at it, kids.
Well, this is an old, old crusty meme, but there was a image going around of their website when all of the records by default had a break this record link on them. You know, like it doesn't matter what the record is. It would just have this like submission form to try and break the record. And so the one that went around was like most people killed in a terrorist attack. And it was like a photo of the Twin Towers
record.
Burning. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the proto version of the Wikipedia. You can help by expanding this list.
Yes. Yes. It's exactly that. So there's a bunch of shifts over time where they try to figure out how to keep records without being encouraging.
Without tacitly encouraging them, yeah.
Yeah, so I think maybe part of why a lot of this stuff is back in the book is that it's just less dangerous now because people decided to stop being such total idiots.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. I mean, I think a lot of it is also just whim-based, right? Where like, yeah, let's take this one out. And then you're like, you know what? We kind of miss it. People are still doing it.
I'm sure if someone managed to like smash the record by like 200% or something, they would have no choice but to put that in. I guess if they're just doing like incremental inch by inch, foot by foot, there's less of a like, hey, we need this. We need to talk about this.
Mm-hmm. So like I said, it was 4 years on when car ramp jumping was just kind of reintroduced to the book. Quote, the longest ramp jump in a car by a professional stunt driver is 232 feet by Jacqueline de Creed in a 1967 Ford Mustang at Santa Pod Raceway, Bedfordshire, England, on April 3rd, 1983. Just for anyone keeping track of the numbers, that 232 feet is well in excess of...
I think it was like 176 before?
The one that Carter is credited with doing is 186 feet in 1982.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So easily smashing his record.
Yeah. So this came up.
This is published in 1981. So this is before he has done his jump, correct?
Well, no. So this was set in 1983. And like, it was, I think, 86 or so when they actually put the category back in.
Oh, okay. My bad.
Yeah, the 81 publication is when they say we discontinued it. So I think it was four editions that went without it.
Gotcha. I was getting mixed up of when they discontinued and when they brought it back.
Yeah, it's extremely confusing. Fun Imagine times. Going through every edition trying to parse it out.
I'm sure the listeners are thrilled with us splitting hairs over like the inner minutiae of the Guinness Book of World Records people and which obviously fraudulent jumps they are listing as records in which year.
Yeah, but that's like 40% of the script by volume, so tough.
Well, yeah. We're talking about stuntmen. Everything is fraudulent.
Yeah. So this is, strictly speaking, this 232 feet comes after the 186 feet, but because that was in a period where they weren't recording it, there's really no way to know if he maybe briefly could have claimed this record before her.
Right.
The listeners will be familiar with this. The viewers will be familiar. You probably would not. Because I just put an interjection in the edit of the previous episode, which is when you look closer at the numbers with some of these records, whether it's the motorcycle jumps, the car jumps, the newspaper articles on Ken Carter, sometimes the distance in feet and the distance in cars is given. And so when you look at the ones that Guinness formalized, like, so this was especially the motorcycle jumps with Evel Knievel and Debbie Lawler and stuff.
Yeah.
You would get these widths where if you divide the number of feet by the number of cars, you get something like 6.5 feet, right? Which is a reasonably appropriate width for a car back then. And obviously there's variability because in some of the videos you can see the cars are right smashed against each other. Sometimes it looks like they have more spacing.
Yeah.
But when you look at Carter's claims, his cars are like 10 feet wide.
Oh, wait. Like if you take the total distance that he jumps and divide by the number of cars, he's like, I have just jumped 180 feet, three whole cars.
Basically, that's more exaggerated, but that's what it is. The way that he makes the claims on his records does not correlate with the number of cars he's jumping.
Right.
So my pet theory...
So either he's got the cars really spaced out or he's just lying.
He's just lying, right. My pet theory, this is totally me speculating after staring at all this text for far too long, is that basically he'll jump the number of cars that he can, which seems to hover around 12 or 13, but he'll just keep increasing the number of feet.
Okay.
To be convenient. Everyone else is just hear me repeat myself, but there's the one where he conveniently his record is just a foot longer than what's currently listed in Guinness. And by currently, I mean one edition before.
Okay.
Which suggests to me that
so
he was
he'd have had time to read it. Like it was already printed at that point.
Right. But if he's like, oh yeah, I jumped 117 feet. It's 1 foot longer than what's in the book. It's like, yeah, but if you had the most recent edition in your hands, you would have known that it was already been broken.
Oh,
it's
okay.
127 now and you're claiming 117.
So he's always playing catch up with the book.
To me, the funniest thing to imagine is that he's like walking around with an outdated copy to use this as
he's got the 1947 copy. He's just like, why won't they put me in? This is so easy.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, lest you think we were free from ambiguity, this ramp jump, so this is Jackie DeCree's ramp jump, is apparently not to be compared to the previous record for T-bone dives because 2 years later, that category reappears separately from the ramp jumping category, with the longest T-bone dive now given as 196 feet 5 inches, set in 1980 by a French man named Jean-Pierre Vigneault, whose name the editors completely misspell.
Hell yeah.
This is another fascinating individual who has a sizzle reel that starts out with him striking martial arts poses while shirtless and includes him claiming to have won the World Karate Championship in Mexico in 1975.
You know what? Whatever. Go off, King. You're a stuntman. You need to legend build. And if I've never heard of you, then you need to like legend build quickly.
He claims this repeatedly in his life. As far as I can tell, it's just a lie. Because like there was a World Karate Championship in 1975, but it was in, this is going from memory, but I think San Diego or something.
I'm sure he just went to like some after school program in Mexico and like beat up a bunch of 6 year olds.
Maybe.
Me, the champion.
He also claims he did stunts for 2000 films, including multiple installments of Mad Max and James Bond. He has IMDb credits for 3 movies and 2 TV episodes you've never heard of. We cannot get into this guy any further. He does not matter.
Oh.
We can't. Jacqueline DeCreed's ramp jumping record would go on to stand long, long past the end of our story, but it is still of interest to us. I tried looking into her more and found a few assertions that her 232-foot jump was indeed record-setting, including one saying that she smashed the previous record. There's very little left online to go off here, but thankfully we have one solid piece from Malaysia's New Straits Times dating to the 19th of February, 1984.
There were some red faces in the macho world of the stuntmen last year. For last year, it was a girl, 26-year-old Jackie Decreed from Islington in North London, who amazed the experts by breaking the world record long-distance car leap by a margin of 11 meters or 35 feet at the Santa Pod drag racing track. Jackie jumped an incredible 72 meters or 232 feet, equivalent to 40 saloon cars or 29 London buses side by side, to claim a well-deserved victory after studying the world of stunting for 6 years, mostly under the eagle eye of Dick Shepherd, one of the most respected and well-known authorities on stunts. When they decided to attempt the record, neither Dick nor Jackie had any doubts that it could be done and wondered why it hadn't been attempted before. All the important factors were checked. They had the right car, the right circuit, and the right person. And Jackie had lost 7 pounds weight to correct the weight balance. So, I mean, I do understand it purely in, like, engineering terms of, like, a 26-year-old girl who has also lost a lot of weight. That's just less mass in the car. That means the car is going to go further. I don't want to claim that that is the only factor, because it seems like she smashed the record by, like, 35 feet, which I don't think comes down to being a little less heavy.
Yeah, I mean, here it says weight balance, so I was thinking they have maybe some sort of like a counterweight in the passenger seat.
Possibly.
But you could just add,
it would be easier to drain the water out of that barrel than to, like, Jackie, you need to lose weight, stat.
Yeah, it's a really weird thing, but it also just is a very funny contrast to the way that we saw Carter and his proteges, the way they were talking about the jumps, where they're like, hey, journalist, you want to hop in the car with me? And the you know, like, oh yeah, we didn't put enough fuel in. So I think this is sort of a midpoint that she takes part in, where it's not quite where it is today in terms of, like, the very precise engineering and, like, the very robust safety, but it seems like a lot better than it was even 10, 15, 20 years before, where we were looking at the previous efforts. Few notes on this. Dick Shepherd, a name no one can agree on the spelling of, once held the Guinness record for most Guinness records, including most cars crashed.
Okay.
Another guy attempting to make a record in the 70s, specifically the motorcycle ramp jump record, was named Dick Stone. Should probably get that checked out.
Hell yeah. Horrible, horrible stunt name. Everyone's just like, why would you pick that? You could have picked such a cooler name. I didn't pick it. That's my real name.
Yeah. When it comes to stunt industry names, Ken is a major one, but Dick is big too.
Mm. Fuck. You're supposed to be professional.
This guy's daughter, I think, posted a phone recording of a DVD on a TV. It's like, yeah, I found this in my dad's old stuff, because her dad was Dick Stone. There's this recording of him going for the record and not making it. He eats shit. And
this is Dick Stone, not Dick Shepherd.
This is Dick Stone.
Okay.
Yeah, I know there's too many dicks in here. I just thought this was a good time to mention I found a guy named Dick Stone. He doesn't have the record.
There is also a stuntman named Dick Stone. Okay.
Yeah, and in the commentary, as he's going off when they're showing the instant replay, the commentator is like, oh, visibly shaken dick there. It's really good.
There's a tremendous amount of emotion and tears, as well as relief. And Dick visibly shaken, being led over here. Dick Stone.
It's really good, right?
Yeah. Riverside will let you make audio drops. You need to make Dick visibly shaken part of your soundboard.
Yeah, I'll have to get on that at some point.
Dick Stone, the Red Devil, as they call him, is a...
Okay, yeah. We got that out of us.
Quick math on Jackie Decreed here. So her ramp jump distance of 232 feet being 35 over the old record, that would make the old mark 197 feet, which astute listeners will remember just happens to be about the listed record for the longest T-bone dive. So even though they kept listing that record, that does seem like the one she was beating, because her ramp jumping record, they say, is 35 feet over, and I can't find any older record for a ramp jump at 197 feet. Decreed's 1983 jump is preserved on YouTube, incidentally, with contemporary voiceover saying she was specifically about to beat a record of 196 feet 5 inches. So that's exactly the T-bone listing.
Okay.
And so that doesn't look good for Ken Carter's claim if his stated distance was 186 feet 2 years after the 196 foot 5 inch T-bone jive by Jean-Pierre Vigneault.
Listener, this is what you get out of this podcast. This is how much like data and OSINT, how much research goes into just categorically figuring out, and this isn't wasted effort, but
yeah.
I could have told you right off the bat that as soon as Ken Carter said he broke a record, I could have told you that that was a lie right there. But we have the data. Kelly has done the research and has figured out empirically, timeline-wise and mathematically, there is no way that Ken Carter is not lying.
Yeah, it's a lot of effort to prove a thing that we really already all knew.
Still, it's good to tick the boxes.
Again, it is the fault of him being a liar, but it's also the fault of Guinness World Records and all these other publications to be...
And just like all of this stuntmen, like debate and whatnot, yeah.
Well, and just not being specific in what the fuck are you measuring and how and why and yeah.
Yeah.
Now, so there's wiggle room. The only claim I might give him is that he was the only one landing on ramps, which doesn't appear to have ever really been a criterion used by anyone else. If we'll allow him this, he may have been the only real ramp-to-ramp record holder before 2009. But regardless, from what I've seen, his name never once made it to print in any edition of Guinness World Records.
Womp womp.
But you know who is in there?
Oh no. Is it our friend, Evil?
No, okay. Evil Knievel obviously is in the record
book. Well, yeah.
But do you know who else from this movie is in the Guinness Book of World Records?
Kenny?
No, it is friend of the pod, Slammin' Sammy Miller.
Oh, okay. Hell yeah.
At the time of this recording, he
is... Worst oil well design ever.
Yeah. At the time of this recording, he is listed on the GWR website for the, quote, fastest rocket-powered ice sled at 399 kilometers per hour set on the 15th of February, 1981.
Okay, I mean, I guess if you're in rocket cars, it's not too much to just slap some skates on there.
Yeah, I believe the one place I read it in, he just took like an existing rocket car, maybe even a funny car, which is a rocket car, and put sleds on it or... Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because it wasn't skates. It was like a sled.
Gotcha.
I don't know what the difference is.
I'd be questionable about the safety because like whenever you're dealing with a rocket car, you can put it on a salt flat that is pretty uniformly flat and you can control it a lot better. I feel like if I'm on ice or in snow, things get a lot more questionable. Mm-hmm. Unless he also just took the sled down to a lake bed. I don't know. Still neat.
Yeah.
It proves that he did somewhat know how to build rockets that didn't explode.
And although this next record category is not listed by Guinness Online, in his rocket-powered funny car Vanishing Point, Sammy Miller set the fastest ever sanctioned quarter mile on a drag strip at 3.58 seconds. One that, as far as I can tell, has stood since 1984.
Nice.
Yeah, there was a YouTube commenter, which is not the best source, but saying that people have beaten, they've done better times than that. So there's even a video of Sammy Miller doing like 3.22, but I saw people wondering, why doesn't this count? Why wasn't this sanctioned? They're at like an event, a drag race event. And I think someone was saying their understanding was because it was not on a drag strip, it was on a straight part of like a curved raceway.
Oh.
Which I guess matters. So
like some kind of legalese there of like it has to be done in a certified.
Yeah.
Okay.
Again, this is just a YouTube commenter, but they were saying that there are other people who have beaten that time, but never on a drag strip.
Does kind of make you wonder why they wouldn't just get a drag strip. Maybe they didn't know. Maybe this was some guardrail thrown up after. But like, if you're going for a record, I feel like I would clear all of the requirements with Guinness first.
Yeah, but regardless, Sammy Miller is in Guinness World Records for that ice sled thing. It's still there. So Jackie DeCreed, as far as I can tell, held the outright car jump distance record for 26 years.
Jesus.
On December 31st, 2009, Travis Pastrana, who we brought up in, I think, the first or second episode, co-founder and head of the action sports collective Nitro Circus, jumped 269 feet from a ramp on a pier to a ramp on a floating barge, a mark that holds up to this day as the longest ramp jump in a car.
Wow. I'd be more worried about missing.
Well, and they give him such a short landing ramp that he hits the landing, slides and slams his car into the back wall of this barge and knocks out the camera because they gave him no deceleration space. It's crazy.
All right. Well, at least he didn't go in.
Well, yeah, but then he runs up the ramp and does a backflip into the water. So
Yeah.
Ruins his microphone pack, clearly.
Well, as long as he wanted to go in the water, better that than being trapped inside my car in the water.
And I did say, I know at one point where I was like, yeah, the modern stuntmen, they're not fucking themselves up because they have all these roll cages and shit. But Travis Pastrana specifically, in one of his car videos, he like puts one out every year doing insane car stunts, like jumping over helicopters and shit.
Jesus.
But it starts with him trying to do a base jump where his chute fucks up and he falls down and breaks his pelvis. So they are still fucking themselves up. I should have clarified that. Yeah. A lot of broken pelvises going on.
A lot of parachute failures.
Yeah. Holy fuck, man.
I'd be really interested to know if they were like trying to do some like custom shit, trying to like mess with their parachutes, because an actual well-rigged parachute by someone who is accredited to do it has like a 1 in 2,000 chance of failing.
Well, you can watch him base jump out of this building and slam into the ground if you want. You can tell me.
God. Maybe the parachute only like half inflated or something. If someone jumps out of a building and has enough altitude that they could conceivably pull a parachute, I'm thinking they're very lucky if they get away from that fall with a broken pelvis only.
He pulled his chute. It does go. I think maybe he goes a bit too late because his chute looks, from memory again, fully open. He's just kind of, he's not doing that nice, like, coast down angle. He just kind of, like, slams into the ground wild.
Okay, like, maybe he goes into a spin. Maybe he goes into a dive or something.
Something like that, yeah.
But yeah, still neat.
Yeah, so if you're counting broken pelvises, also one of the last jumps Knievel did, he broke his pelvis and, like, walked off.
Nice.
In immense pain. So the field has become fragmented again, as that record is now tracked separately from longest ramp jump in a four-wheeled vehicle, which seems to have been set earlier in the same month by a driver named Johnny Greaves, who set successive records of 270, 293, and 301 feet in something called a Pro 2 racing truck, which seems to be kind of a standard for people making crazy souped up things now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's this very weird monster truck looking thing. There's some point at which you escape the definition of car, and they've split the records again for that purpose.
Okay. So this is like a rally truck, effectively. I'm looking at this. It looks like a very low pickup truck. It looks like a pickup truck about as high up as like a normal car.
Yeah.
And yeah, like very clearly built for rally stuff, for jumps, for off-roading.
Well, and Pastrana's jump is in a rally car, so there's still a distinction being made there.
Yeah.
But yeah, especially those rally trucks, like when you watch this, because this stuff is so well documented now, right? You just get Red Bull, GoPro, and shit to sponsor you.
Yeah.
And you get amazing, like, slow-mo, high-def footage of this. And so these racing trucks have insane suspension on them. Like, that's what you notice about them is they're designed to land in a punishing way and just keep going. Because unlike Ken Carter, where it's like, okay, you jump and then you T-bone a bunch of cars and have to get pulled out and like put your leg in a cast, these guys are able to do multiple jumps in the same day because they can drive away from their landings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big difference. So this was followed by a 332-foot jump by Tanner Faust using another Pro 2 in 2011, then a 379.4-foot jump by Bryce Menzies in 2016, now listed as the longest pickup truck ramp jump by Guinness, although it is still the longest shot for any four-wheeled vehicle. That is, of course, any vehicle that stuck the landing. Crashes now unambiguously don't count, as Guerlain Chicheri learned while eating absolute shit on a 360-foot attempt in 2014. A spectacular crash video I also highly recommend.
I'm going to have to watch a whole bunch of videos after this.
Well, this is what's in the playlist that I made. So again, it's linked in the description. Okay. Every video I talk about or have put into the edit is in this playlist, so you can watch all these things kind of in chronological order. Yeah, viewers will have seen it already because I visually edited it into part two, but you have these like interior cockpit GoPros going on, and so you can watch him as this thing is flipping and flipping and flipping, and like you can watch him try to slowly pull his arms down and tuck his elbows in so he doesn't sever his arm out the roll cage of this thing, which can definitely happen. It makes me anxious to watch every time, but it's also very fun to watch. And he's like, fine. He gets up.
Okay, sweet.
I bring all this up because I want everyone to recall a record category that briefly popped into the record book in 1975. The longest jump into water, listed then at 203 feet. In the spirit of that record, if we are to put aside a landing you can drive away from as a requirement, then despite all the massive jumps I just mentioned, the outright furthest that anyone's ever launched themselves in a car off a ramp was in 1979 when Kenny Powers launched himself 506 feet into the water of the St. Lawrence Seaway. So Kenny Powers should be in Guinness.
It all comes back, yeah.
So, I mean, he smashed the car jump into water record if nobody had beaten that. I can also see why that's a record that they can't condone you doing.
Yeah, like maybe don't try this at home, kids.
I think something even more interesting emerges here, though, if we're talking subcategories. When I mentioned land speed records, I talked about how thrust-powered vehicles took over from internal combustion engines for the overall title. Today, when it comes to the record for land speed, there is a category split between wheel-driven and thrust-powered vehicles. By that rubric, then I am pretty certain that among those who have stuck the landing, Ken Carter has still truly jumped farther in a rocket-powered car than anyone else ever has.
I get.
He does land a rocket-powered jump, so we have video evidence of him doing that.
There have not been many attempts for like rocket-propelled car distance jumps.
I suspect Ken Carter may have even been the last to ever attempt jumping in a rocket-powered car. The only time I've seen anyone try to send a rocket car up and off a ramp was the Mythbusters, and theirs was remote-controlled and exploded in a giant fireball.
I guess that also depends on the definition of rocket car versus rocket with wheels, if they make that distinction.
Mm.
Because if so, then Eddie Braun in The Evil Spirit may have a... maybe part of that.
But he parachute landed. He didn't like
ramp land. Oh, he didn't ramp land. Yeah, yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah, again, this is a category of my own devising, but... Before we leave our friends at Guinness World Records behind for good, I want you to read one last unhinged entry from them.
Oh, boy.
This one remained in the book for many years, at least across editions that I was reading for this episode.
So, this is the Guinness Book of World Records achievement for fastest psychiatrist. We are in the category human achievements. The world's fastest psychiatrist was Dr. Albert L. Wiener of Earlton, New Jersey, USA, who dealt with up to 50 patients a day in 4 treatment rooms. He relied heavily on narcoanalysis, muscle relaxants, and electroshock therapy. In December 1961, he was found guilty on 12 counts of manslaughter from using unsterilized needles. Hell yeah.
Cool.
I feel like they should like caveat, what does dealt with a patient mean? Because he seems to have dealt with 12 patients pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And even the ones that he wasn't murdering, his method of dealing with them was like, all right, electroshock therapy, 3, 2, 1, go, next.
Yeah, this one should have been first on their list for, oh, maybe let's not list this record.
maybe don't put a serial killer in. Just like, yeah, he's actually kind of the best.
But what of our hero, the Mad Canadian? Where did he go from his 186-foot ramp-to-ramp rocket car jump? Well, as he told us, he was dead set on making the St. Lawrence jump happen. That meant, in a practical sense, he was back on the circuit fundraising. Many of the sources I read casually mentioned that he jumped over a 2-story building in Lancaster, New York, somewhere around mid-1982. Being quite tired of trying to fact-check things that were difficult or impossible to verify, and, you know, from a known liar, I initially didn't bother with this at all, until I saw a photo of it happening. Have you seen this photo?
I have not seen this photo. The ramp truck, if I'm drawing a line, the thing that's fucking me up here is that I think they're offset from the building a little bit. I think they're jumping over the slanted part of the roof instead of the peak of the roof. Because if I draw a line from that ramp truck, like the path of the ramp, it hits the building.
It turns out this absolutely happened, and you can watch the video of it, and it rules. Is genuinely very cool. Yeah, and he...
Also, the guy... you know this is the 80s, because as I'm looking at this picture of, like, a car tumbling through the air about to crash, there's a dude in, like, all white with, like, really nice hair actively running towards the car.
Yeah, if you're just listening, we basically were looking at 2 different photos of Ken Carter jumping a car over... At least it's a 2-story building. I mean, even if you had a flat roof, it is a 2-story building. So he's not jumping over the tallest part of the peak, but I mean, I'm still going to give it to him.
Yeah, I mean, it meets the definition.
Yeah, so like this is a genuinely impressive and like terrifying looking jump. So
yeah.
In 1983, he was able to convince the owners of the Westgate Speedway near Peterborough, Ontario, to allow him to set up a ramp-to-ramp jump over a murky pond, which Carter stated was 18 feet deep.
Okay.
On July 31st, Wikipedia's date of July 1st is probably wrong as far as I can tell. And on July 31st, he was at the wheel of a black rocket-propelled Pontiac Firebird, again, fully controlled by the car's pedals and steering wheel as usual. Which is at least a cooler shape for your car to be than a Lincoln Continental, in my opinion.
Well, yeah. Bit more aerodynamic, I hope.
What follows, when you first watch it, looks a lot like a snuff film. Ken immediately loses control, hits the jump sideways, and corkscrews beautifully into the pond, sinking immediately.
Oh, no. It is...
So you haven't seen this video?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's so good. It is miraculous that the safety crew, such as it was able to extricate him from the rapidly sinking vehicle. The car was later pulled back up from the depths and cleaned out in preparation of the Mad Canadian's next attempt, which he said would be on the upcoming Labor Day weekend. So he's like soaking wet after coming out of this pond, and he's saying into the mic like, "We'll be back here on Labor Day."
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. To his credit, they had divers on site, and so as soon as he goes into the pond, you just watch this thing sink like the fucking X-Wing in Dagobah. You're like, well, that's it. And I guess he held his breath. They go down. They like put the regulator on him and pull him up.
He had to let the pressure equalize. Yeah.
Well, I think like he had his windows open the whole time, right? Because it's kind of this stunt car thing.
Oh, okay. So
No, because immediately the water just rushes in the windows. And so that's where they pull him out through.
Gotcha.
Incidentally, back when Carter was being interviewed by the Ottawa Citizen the previous October about Hugh Kennedy's creditors, he was pitching Labor Day 1983 as the next date for the St. Lawrence River jump off the big ramp, with the promise of, in the words of the reporter, quote, a three-day festival with midway rides and rock stars, end quote.
Okay, fine.
If you've seen the video, there are no midway rides and rock stars. He is next to a murky dirt pond with just a bunch of people watching.
Yep.
Yeah, instead he found himself struggling to jump a pond out behind a speedway in rural Ontario.
Kind of like how the mighty have fallen. Obviously still doing cool jumps, but you went from trying to jump across a river to jumping, you know, it is a jump over a two-story building, but it is the most like child's ass drawing of a house I have ever seen. It is not an exciting building. It looks like, I don't even think that building is meant to be there. Like, it looks like they set it up for the jump.
Oh yeah, no, it looks like they
like
just...
it's like a prefab, like no one is going inside that thing.
Yeah,
but then you're just down to like, I'm gonna jump over Scruffy's pond, let's go.
Yeah, I think in the house case, because they're clearly on a track if I remember correctly, so they just I guess framed the most basic house, the most basic two-story blocks building they could.
Yeah.
On a ramp. But they like put actual roofing and siding on it, I guess. You know, I guess.
I don't know. The roofing, from how kind of uneven it looks like they just threw a tarp over top to me.
Yeah, maybe. And so on the 3rd of September, Ken Carter lined up for the jump again. According to the retrospective, Stuntman to the End, he even had, quote, a renowned rocket propulsion expert, end quote, on hand to determine the correct amount of fuel for the jump. Seems smart.
Willing to bet they said all of it.
But if you followed this whole story, then you'll surely know that Ken Carter was not a man who believed in the knowledge of trained experts.
Huh.
Ken Carter was a man who believed in his gut. And his gut said, needs more rocket fuel.
Fuck. Okay. All right. No. He deserves all of this.
Yeah. Presumably the expert is saying, okay, like, this is how much you need. And he's like, oh, yeah.
This is how far you want to go. So this is how much you need. This is math.
Yeah, it's just a little fuel. It goes away, right?
Yeah, you know.
I know what you're probably thinking, but let me assure you, Ken Carter did not meet a grisly rocket-fueled end on September 3rd, 1983. Due to a series of delays, because what is a Ken Carter stunt without delays, Ken's big launch would have to wait until a little after midnight. Ken hit the gas, the car took off, hit the ramp straight, and cleared the pond easily. It even cleared the landing ramp easily.
Nice.
The extra fuel was more than enough to give the Firebird the forward momentum it needed. It also gave it the upward momentum it didn't need, which resulted in the car rotating end over end as it sailed overhead and overshot its target by 100 feet.
Okay.
So the different podcast, Canadian History X, says it was a 200-foot target, and Autofocus says 60 meters, so...
ballpark-ish.
It at least seems agreed upon. And so he's got, yeah, so 200-foot target, and he's got 100 feet over it.
Okay. And his car is wildly spinning through the air.
Yeah, so the car slams smack down on its roof after turning over 180 degrees.
Okay.
This footage is also shown in Stuntman to the End. This is a snuff film.
Fuck. Okay, yeah.
So fair warning to anyone watching the last documentary, you will be shown the footage of him dying.
So cargo is spinning wildly out of control, overshoots its target point by 50% and lands smack on its roof. I'm assuming killing him instantly.
Well, okay, so despite the best efforts of rescuers to pull him out and resuscitate him, he was pronounced dead on arrival at the hospital with what were termed massive head, chest, and other internal injuries.
Oh.
Some stories will say he died instantly. This comes up a lot in just kind of reporting on people's like high-impact deaths.
I mean, people like to say died instantly because it means no pain, no suffering. So
yeah. So if you get like your head taken off cleanly by a helicopter, sure, you are essentially instantly dead. Generally speaking, people don't die instantly.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, it's like no matter how hard
painless
you get,
death is a myth, everybody.
Yeah, I mean, he could have been knocked out instantly for sure, but you die slowly. And the way the cop describes trying to give him CPR in the ambulance and like getting a pulse back, like, yeah, I don't know. This is getting into EMS
grisly
stuff that no one cares about, yeah. But you're that line between like alive and dead is quite blurry, and yeah. That's why you get pronounced dead on arrival. Like, it's an adage of, you know, no one.
We need a professional. Yeah. Like even in the most extreme cases, you do kind of need a professional to say like, no, this is it.
Yeah. Basically it's not within your scope to declare someone dead. So nobody is formally dead until you get to the hospital essentially. So
mm-hmm.
For another first hand account, here is an old boomer post I found on a forum by user Dual Quad Pete.
God damn it.
Yeah, I don't know how to read this, so this is why I made it your problem.
All right, so Dual Quad Pete, I will identify how many... every single sentence has one more exclamation point on it. This rules.
I mean, I do that all the time.
I was there at the Westgate Mall the night he overshot the pond. Overshot, for some reason, is in quotation marks.
Yeah, boomer quotes, for sure.
Two exclamation points. All caps. Not pretty, and I can still hear the thump in my mind of the car landing upside down and the cage collapsing. 3 exclamation points. Car was a, all caps, pancake when we saw it afterwards. Roll cage looked like it was made out of exhaust tubing. 4 exclamation points.
And here is Dual Quad Pete's forum signature.
Sometimes I wake up, all caps, grumpy, but today I let her sleep in. 7 exclamation points. Blackstock, Ontario.
Blackstock, all caps.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a
Dual Quad Pete, all respect to you.
For the sake of journalistic accuracy, there are 8 exclamation marks at the end there, and they appear to
My
be,
bad.
There appears to be an indent before the exclamation marks. So it's like, I let her sleep in, pause. No, like this is copy pasted verbatim.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, sorry. The version you're looking at, you can't see the gap.
Yeah, because it just kind of works out. But I do trust that there is an indent there for some reason.
Yeah.
I can still hear the thump in my mind and the car landing upside down and the cage collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, like, I love an incredibly traumatic event, presumably for this man. Maybe even a child at the time, like someone who is actively saying, I can still hear the smash and of a man dying in my mind all these years later, being translated through text that sounds like it's from a Minion Death Cult episode.
Yeah.
I'm just like, why would you all caps that? Why do I need to know? Like, why does your PTSD need to be given to me in 3 exclamation points in all caps?
Well, and I think that raises a good point too, which is if you watch the Stuntman to the End documentary, so including the host who was there at the time and several of the people interviewed who were involved, they all really describe it as it's like a thing I'll never forget. Yeah, because it's fucking traumatic. You had to watch a guy
got squished.
Yeah. like, we have the benefit of distance and kind of the abstraction of this guy died in 1983. Oh, I'm going to watch a video. Yeah. And you watch the car smack and you know it kills him. But you're not the one who has to pull the body out. You're not the one trying to do CPR in this corpse.
Yeah.
You're not there expecting a fun show and being suddenly horribly confronted with this guy who got himself killed. And I think that's, you know, that's important, I think, in terms of you kind of fucked around and found out. That's all nice and tidy for your story, but you traumatized a bunch of people. So there is a bit of,
yeah,
I think that just needs to be kept in mind of like, that sucks. You shouldn't do that.
People brought their kids to see the fun jump. And then a man was, you know, mulched. Like, I'm not going to make too many jokes about it. Yeah. Like he died horribly in front of everybody.
That's kind of the thing where I'm like, I kind of do have to feel, I'm finally canceling this dead guy, but like, yeah, don't do this to other people. It's not just you.
You checked out early, you know, everyone yeah. else got to deal with the consequences.
Well, and so Ken Carter never got to set up the jump over Niagara Falls he'd been trying to hype up to people.
Dang.
He certainly never got to jump the St. Lawrence Seaway. The ramp was disassembled years later, and all that remains is some overgrown asphalt.
We need to go there.
Yeah, well,
this
I
needs
mean,
to be like the Hajj.
This is what I was saying this on Discord is you Ottawa people, you can do a little pilgrimage there when it's nice out.
Ooh.
I mean, it might be on someone's property, but yeah, this photo I think was taken by, or at least submitted to that one Facebook page. So like people have gone there. So the asphalt is still there, if not the entire rest of the ramp.
Oh, that is cool.
Yeah, the end, no moral.
Well, so some stories don't need a moral. Don't be a stuntman, listener, but if you are going to be a stuntman, don't flip your car upside down. Wheels down. That's what I always say. Mm. Car likes wheel down.
I should say that's the end of Ken Carter's story, but there is a little bit of postscript here. At least one future daredevil would try to carry on the spirit of the stunt. From North Country Public Radio, quote,
in 2014, American stuntman Mad Mike Hughes announced he was going to jump from Morrisburg to Ogden Island, not in a car, but with a superheated water rocket sort of attached to his back. Hughes' plan was shelved, though, because the town and other authorities would not grant the required permits. Damn it. It was easier to be a stuntman on public roads, disrupt St. Lawrence Seaway traffic, and use a rocket to cross the border at an unofficial site in the 70s than it is today. Goddamn government won't let me ride a bottle rocket jetpack to my death.
So does the name Mad Mike Hughes sound at all familiar to you?
I'm sure you're going to tell me.
I am going to tell you. I wanted to know because I was like, maybe you remember this.
I'm racking my brains of like, well, okay, he's trying to do some like mad Canadian stuff, but it's somewhere in the back of my mind, but put me out of my misery here.
If the name Mad Mike Hughes sounds at all familiar, it might be because he was the self-financed amateur rocketeer who died when his homemade rocket slammed into the ground from great
that
height
guy?
In February 2020 while trying to prove that the Earth was flat.
He's the flat Earth guy? Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's okay. He's that
guy. Yeah. Future FTL episode, I'm sure.
Absolutely. It's in the list. That, oh my God.
Well, dibs guest on that. That's going to be great.
If you want, absolutely.
Yeah, that was a fun little thing. Like
that. Okay.
It's a real who's who of stuntmen, this story. Like we really cover everyone.
This dumb story, like catamaraning its way through all of these historical stuntman figures who all get involved for various reasons. Evil Knievel somehow being the voice of reason and then attempting to murder a dude.
Mm-hmm.
Mad Mike Hughes trying to carry on the legacy of the Mad Canadian and then killing himself in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Mad Mike Hughes, also someone who didn't pack his parachutes properly. I will bang this gavel as like I will hammer this as long as I have to. All of these guys who almost die in rocket cars either don't have parachutes or they've got bad parachutes.
Speaking on the subject of running themes throughout the episode, another theme being snuff films, you can watch this guy slam into the ground as well.
Ooh. Yeah, it's rough.
I think there's a lady you can overhear in the one video like
who's like screaming. Yeah, I don't like watching it for that reason of like the people on the ground are very clearly reacting and like, oh, he's dead.
Yeah. Well, again, don't traumatize people around you by being an idiot.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think there was one person in the video who you can just like hear very plainly saying, oh, he's dead.
Well,
yep, not wrong. As for the future, there is one thing to look forward to. On November 14th, 2024, it was announced that actor Jay Baruchel? How do you say that? I should have looked it up. Jay Baruchel and director Michael Dowes, who previously collaborated on the 2011 film Goon, were set to reunite to make a film called The Stunt Driver, a comedy based on Carter and the events of The Devil at Your Heels.
I'm really hoping they lay the fuck into him. You know, because if you're making a comedy about Ken Carter, he's not the hero. He's not even the hero of his own story. I hope you make a comedy about the man he actually was, which is like a fraud, a charlatan, a man who lied about every single record he did.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be him as the villain. Make it, every single stuntman is the exact same. They are all funny brackets bad.
Yeah, I mean, I know film projects get announced and don't always happen, but I hope it happens and I hope it's good. I think when I was showing the first episode here to my friends, and one of them was saying, like, this guy should be played in a movie by Danny McBride. And I'm like, that's really not impossible. That might happen.
Okay, yeah, because whenever you were telling, like, oh, like Jay Baruchel, like that actor, I was like, doesn't look anything like him. But I guess, yeah, they're just like organizing the project. It's not necessarily him playing Ken Carter.
Well, I think he's writing it because I think he wrote Goon. Okay. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, Jay Baruchel, Danny McBride, they were both in Tropic Thunder, so they're not like unrelated. Hey,
I hope that gets made. I hope it sees the light of day.
Also, they're making a new Evel Knievel movie starring Leonardo DiCaprio.
Fun.
As if we didn't have. This also, can we, have you encountered the movie Viva Knievel?
No.
So there's been a bunch of like biographical, like documentary stuff on Evel Knievel. This one is... it's more like an Elvis movie where he's playing like a fictionalized version of himself, I think.
Okay.
If you ever want to cover that for like a movie bonus.
Absolutely.
Well, we've had a lot of fun today, but now it's time to do our homework. The assignment, as always, can we connect Ken, the mad Canadian Carter, to the real star of Canuck as a Slur, George, Canada's boyfriend, Srombolopoulos? Let's find out.
Get on it.
In The Devil at Your Heels, Ken Carter is seen conferring on the St. Lawrence Jump with lesser daredevil Robert Craig Knievel, better known to the world as Evil. Knievel himself sometimes mingled with lesser daredevils, such as the time he invited Tony Hawk out to Montana for an extremely rad photo shoot. Do you want to describe what we're seeing here?
We are seeing Evel Knievel, a very elderly Evel Knievel, riding a Harley motorcycle. With Tony Hawk appropriately wearing a helmet, skateboarding behind it, he's wearing the Evel Knievel jacket, and he's just got a hand on the seat of the motorcycle to like keep himself going. Also, they seem to be just going through like a random suburban neighborhood.
Well, because Knievel lived out in Butte, Montana. Like, he never became a big city guy.
Yeah.
He's got to be away from all the New Yorkers and lawyers and Jews.
And it's in black and white, or like sepia tone for some reason, even though I'm sure this is in like the 90s or 2000s.
So Tony Hawk has made separate posts giving the date as either 1999 or 2001. Hmm. The official Evel Knievel account says 2001. In fairness to Tony, he's had a lot of traumatic brain injuries.
Well, yeah, who to trust in this story?
Also, you described him as very elderly. Like, how old do you think he looks here?
I will say he's not very elderly. He looks like Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
Basically. He's got like a very receding hairline. He's got white hair. Mm-hmm. He's got these kind of like semi aviator sunglasses and like a polo shirt. I don't know. I'm willing to bet like 60s.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. So I would give you the credit here that in the last 10 years or so of his life, he looks like shit because he is dying of all of his. Like he had all these injuries. So he was on acetaminophen, I think. So I think he fucked up his liver doing that.
Jesus.
And then, he had diabetes, which could be related to
massive internal trauma and cocktail of drugs he has to be on 24/7.
Yeah. And he was being portrayed as like a heavy alcohol user, or at least that's what he beat the guy with a baseball bat for. So I think he was probably also not helping his health problems with that. So. Yeah,
gotcha.
If this is 2001, he would have turned 63, I think, in 2001.
Okay.
So I do think that he looks older than he is because he has lived a rough life. And basically from this point onward, like he's feeling like shit. He's in chronic pain. It's
yeah.
Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy, but it probably felt fucking awful because yeah, you smashed your body into a pulp. It's going to hurt.
Yep.
Actually, it reminds me of like an interview that I think it was when Tony Hawk was on Pete Holmes, but he was like, I can't turn my head because like he can't turn his head all the way because he's fucked up his neck so bad.
Oh, okay. Just like, yeah, it's all plates and staples in there.
Yeah. So yeah, on the subject of Tony Hawk, his worst crash, he has said, came in 2003 when he fell from the peak of a full pipe loop and suffered a concussion in addition to a broken thumb, skull, and pelvis. There's that broken pelvis again. The reason Tony Hawk was on the loop at all was because he was filling in on the TV show Wild Boys for the intended stunt performer, Stephen Gilchrist Glover, better known to the world as Steve-O. Glover had been unable to ride the pipe himself as he'd just recently, in his words, shattered his ankle, necessitating, quote, 11 screws, end quote,
jeez,
as he explained on his Wild Ride podcast in 2021 while interviewing Mr. Hawk. But in January of 2013, it was Steve-O who was the guest on George Strombolopoulos Tonight.
Okay, we've done it.
We've done it. And so I don't know where else to put this, but in the course of researching a lot of these figures, I fell into a hole that is probably very familiar to pro wrestling fans, namely learning about Antonio Inoki, the guy who kicked the shit out of Muhammad Ali. So that it's interesting, that same promoter who is had the funny quote about how much Evel Knievel hated the lawyers, Jews, and New Yorkers, was saying that the guy kicked up Ali's legs so bad that he got these like open wounds on his legs. They got infected and he nearly had to have his legs amputated.
Jesus.
So one of Inoki's oddest moves as a Japanese political figure was to visit Iraq in 1990 as part of a sort of self-directed diplomatic mission to push for the release of 41 Japanese nationals being held hostage by the Hussein regime. It's hard to say exactly what went down, but the story that came out of it was that he was credited with the release of the hostages, or at least 36 of them. I wasn't able to find any concrete evidence that the dictator had ever interacted with the wrestler directly, but Saddam's psychotic son and minister of sport, Uday Hussein, was photographed with Antonio Inoki, the man who kicked Muhammad Ali's leg so hard they got infected and nearly amputated.
Still, I think Uday Hussein is the infinitely more scary person in that picture.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Terrifying man. So Saddam Hussein's son, Uday Hussein, photographed with Antonio Inoki, who kicked the shit out of Muhammad Ali's legs, who in turn was managed for a time by Shelley Saltman, the promoter who had the shit beat out of him by Evel Knievel, which means, for anyone keeping track, Ken Carter was, at most, 6 degrees of separation from Saddam Hussein.
Hell yeah.
Completely meaningless trivia. I'm sorry.
No, it's still fun to have.
And that is the end of this script and the end of part four. Quinn, thank you so much for grabbing onto the back of my motorcycle on your skateboard and riding the whole way through.
Riding it all the way through an incredibly weird story that took so many stupid turns.
And I think a surprise violent crime in every part.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we got the assassination of the Guinness guys.
Yeah, and then you've got the Kenny Powers stabbing a guy.
Yes.
And then you have
Evel Knievel assaulting his agent.
Evel Knievel violently assaulting a bunch of people. And the fourth part, I think, is just Ken Carter violently assaulting himself. But
yeah.
So that's it. I hope everyone learned a lot of important lessons they can carry through into their regular life.
A lot of morals to bring. A lot, you know, I really think you should teach what you've learned here today to everyone else, your fellow Canadians. Anyone, anywhere, you know, just spread the good word. And that being the word that you have taken out of these episodes. I'm not going to tell you what it is for legal reasons.
You know what? Better yet, just sit them down and force them to watch or listen to this episode. And while you do that, you got lots of free time. You can like, subscribe, comment. What are all the other things? Leave a review on podcasting platforms. Do all of those things.
Join the Patreon, pay yeah. money, join yeah. the Patreon, then join the YouTube, then set up a coffee, and then they can pay you that way. Or just mail a bunch of unattended bills and loonies, you know, just put them in the mail, send them out somewhere.
Throw loonies at me, I will stick a poster in my asshole, you can throw... The loonies try to hit the poster, and then I will pick them up with a magnet after.
Yeah.
This is, again, going to be very confusing for people who have not watched previous episodes, but...
We need to make sure that Kelly can achieve the Guinness Book of World Records for fastest podcaster, most number of recordings in a day, although several of the guests did die of audio spikes.
Look, I would settle for the Guinness World Record for highest Patreon income. Is that so much to ask?
Is that...
So that's, well, I'll just finish my plug. So you can find Canuck as a Slur on all platforms, all the platforms that matter and haven't pissed me off, looking at you, Macedon. And yeah, you can, like I said, join our Discord. You can hop on our Patreon, get a bonus episode every month, and help me turn this show into my job, because it is at least a full-time job's worth of work to put this out. So anything you can do to help keep the dream alive, I will... owe you forever
and repay you in content.
I gotta set some Patreon stretch goals. Like, if you give me X dollars a month, then I will maintain a nasty Ken Carter goatee at all times.
Oh god,
that could be fun.
Make it a high tier.
But those are my plugs. Quinn, do you want to plug your shows? Your show.
Yes.
I don't know why I said shows.
You know, maybe there'll be more. Yes, I am a host of Failure to Launch, a space history podcast where we talk about bad things happening to people who go up, which is part of why I've loved hearing the story of Ken Carter and all of the rocket car antics. If that is something that interests you, come on over. We've had Kelly on for a couple of episodes, so there is plenty of crossover material, and there's bound to be more in the future.
All right, well, until next time, on San Carlos.
Car likes wheels down, everybody. Don't flip your car like that.
Canuck is a Slur is an independent, collaborative effort to present a critical, progressive perspective on Canadian history and culture.
Drop them.
To make consistent, high-quality content, we need your support.
Let's tangle.
Head on over to patreon.com/CanuckIsASlur to sign up.
Beauty.
If you're still on the fence, well, here's the sales pitch. Patrons at the good old Canadian boy level unlock expanded access to our Discord server, including sneak peeks at upcoming episodes.
Let's go!
Patrons at the good old Ontario boy level will also get into our archive of bonus content, which includes an extra episode every month. Patrons at the good old Kingston boy level get to commission a free piece of bad art every month as well, in addition to further special Discord privileges.
What a pup! Oh, how she loves the Stanley Cup! Hockey man is what I am! Let's go! Listen to what I say! Play that game the Canadian way! Hockey man is what I am! Let's go!
We'd love for you to come and follow us on our various socials, which you can find linked in the episode description. You can also see any further links for our guests and co-hosts there as well. The creators of this work would like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples across the continent that had their homes stolen, land broken up by arbitrary borders, cultures suppressed, languages banned, children kidnapped, and who were subjected to many other forms of colonial violence. We also acknowledge the many treaties broken and still unceded territories across Turtle Island. Thanks for listening, eat the rich, and happy trails to you.
Dick Stone, the Red Devil.
Please, please, he cleared the whole thing.
There's a tremendous amount of emotion and tears, as well as relief. And Dick visibly shaken. Poor Dick.
Look at that. Look at that.
Dick Stone, the Red Devil.